Hello and welcome. Tonight we're going to dive into our first unit on substantive property. Last time we spoke about property rights, and tonight we're going to talk about personal property. Tonight's our introduction to personal property. Last time we talked about our rights in property, how property needs to be viewed as a collection of rights, and the founders' view on property and how critical our property rights were to the founders and how intrinsically connected that is to the concept of freedom. How important it is for all people to have their property rights respected and maintained. And why do we recognize property rights? There's a whole host of reasons, including the fact that it is so intrinsically linked to fairness and freedom. John Locke, in his two treatises on government, listed that there's three major rights: life, liberty, and the pursuit of property. And the founders believed that to their very core. We also talked at length last time about the four postulates, the four things which are the most important answers in this class, and they will be on both the midterm and the final. And they are as follows. The property needs to be seen as a collection of rights, not as a collection of things. The property and the law are intertwined. Without property, you don't have law because you don't have the cases and controversy which arose out of property disputes primarily. And without the law, you don't have property because property protects our property, or the law protects our property rights. So the two are intrinsically intertwined. And you need the law to protect our property rights. You need property rights to build that body of case law, which became the common law. Thirdly, property rights are inherent to our humanity. As we just mentioned, John Locke expressed that we have three major rights as human beings: one, life; second, liberty; and the third, the pursuit of property. That was expressed a little bit more elegantly by Thomas Jefferson in our Declaration of Independence when he declared it to be life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if you may recall from our last lecture, when he was asked 50 years later, what is the difference between Locke's view and his view, he said there is no difference. He said pursuit of happiness means pursuit of property because you can't have one without the other. And as a result of that, you look at property rights as intrinsically inherent to our humanity. And Jefferson declared it in our Declaration that we have the right of property and that we're endowed with that right from our Creator. That means that it can't be taken away from us from government. That property rights are inherent to us as human beings, and our pursuit of property is something that we can always pursue, and it's intrinsically linked to our freedom. And lastly, what are our property rights, and how are they exercised? Well, they're through EPUT, as we use that acronym. It's exclude, possess, use, and transfer. You get to exclude others from your property. If you have that property, you get to possess that property. You get to use that property, and you get to transfer that property. All these are rights that you have. And why is it so important to have property rights? Well, it's very simple. It's not the item itself that's intrinsically important. It's your right to be able to exercise these EPUT rights that make it so valuable. You don't care if you own the car if you get to use it. You don't care if you own the house if you get to exclude other people from using it. And you get to possess it. And you get to sell it. All those things are your rights in property, and they're the most important part. Okay. We also wrapped up last time by saying there's three types of property. You have real property, which are real rights in land. You have personal property, which is your rights in objects, things that are movable. And then you have intellectual property, which are patents, copyrights, and trademarks, which are rights and ideas. And lastly, we wrapped up last time with the case of Dred Scott v. Sanford. That was the famous case involving slavery in the 1850s that kind of brought on the Civil War. The concept in that case, which was written by Roger Taney, and the reason it brought on the Civil War is because, if you may remember, Taney used a procedural trick to keep people in bondage, to say that people were property. Well, people aren't property, and they should have never been viewed as such. Slavery was an inherent evil that sadly took hundreds of thousands of American lives before we were able to eliminate. 380,000 Northern white people had to die, as well as many millions of African Americans had to suffer in order to end that scourge. And the Dred Scott case really brought this to a conclusion. And what we might remind you of was the brilliant and rather beautiful commentary and dissent by Benjamin Curtis in that case, where he viewed that slavery could not be held under the Constitution because every African American was a person under the law. And as a result of that, they were entitled to those rights that Jefferson announced and that were incorporated within the United States Constitution by reference through the Ninth Amendment, that all these persons, all these African Americans, could not have their rights abridged, and that Dred Scott should have been freed because of the Northwest Ordinance's provision that there couldn't be slavery. We point out that in that case. And again, out of all the horrors of that time and of this case, whereby Taney used a procedural trick to try and continue slavery, because as you remember, Taney came from a slave state, and he was from Maryland. He was a bigot, he was a racist, and he uses a procedural trick saying, hey, Dred Scott's not a citizen of the United States, and as such, he's not allowed into court. If he ever got into court, I suspect that Curtis would have won the day on the decision, and slavery would have been outlawed in the United States, but we'll never know, because obviously the decision was written by Taney, and this really helped to bring on the Civil War, because it continued slavery as a legal institution in the United States. And it was none other than Abraham Lincoln who pointed to this case, saying what an injustice it was and how they missed an opportunity to really end slavery in the law. And as we get through another time in our American history when the Supreme Court is highlighted, this was a case that can show that the Supreme Court can do great good or can do great harm. And in this case, it did great harm. And hopefully it can be corrected just the way that the Dred Scott case was. And remember, at the end of the day, Dred Scott did get his freedom because the young man that he grew up with, who was the son of the original slave owner who purchased Dred Scott, was able to purchase his freedom for him and his wife. So the story does have a happy ending, despite the fact that it was such a gross miscarriage of justice. Okay, this week we're going to talk and dive right into the warm waters of personal property. We're going to start out with the meaning of property and personal property with the right enforcement of your EPUT rights. We're going to do a unit on wild animals. The law is somewhat obsessed with wild animals, and we're going to talk about possession and capture and return and regulation. Wild animals are so important in the law because they're the only property that has never been owned. And as a result of that, everybody owns something else out there, whether it be land or it be personal property before you had that. So wild animals are a great exception to that. That's one of the reasons why legal scholars are kind of obsessed with them, because it's an example of how you can start with unowned property. Because a wild animal is viewed as owned by no one in its wild state. And we'll talk about all that. And lastly, we're going to wrap up our lectures today with a discussion on how do you acquire rights and property, personal property. There's a number of ways to do it. You can get it through what is called occupancy or possession. You actually possess the property. You can get it by buying it. You purchase it by sale. You can get it by adverse possession. We'll get into what that is. You can get it by accession or confusion. You can get it by a legal judgment. A court declares that is your property. You can get it by finding it if it's been lost or mislaid or abandoned. And lastly, you can get it by a gift. And we're going to wrap up tonight's session with one of the more interesting cases in American history. It is the quintessential case that mere pursuit is not possession of property. It involves a wild animal. And it is the case of Pearson v. Post. If you go to law school, this is one of the very first property cases that you will learn about, primarily because of the fact that, again, legal scholars are so obsessed with wild animals. And because this animal was unowned when it started, that it is illustrative of how people gain possession of property. Okay, let's jump right in. We're going to do a brief review of last week with the four postulates because they are so important. Now, again, you will see these not only on the midterm, but you're going to see them on the final because they explain our whole course. What's it about? Where's it going? What are your elements of personal and real and intellectual property? They're all explained by the four postulates. First and foremost is that property needs to be seen as a collection of rights, not a collection of things. Again, your rights and your property is what is most important. It's not the item itself, but it's your right to exercise those e-put rights in the property that make it valuable. Number two, property rights are those recognized by law, and the law evolved from property rights. Remember that the law's purpose is to protect your rights, including your property rights. If you don't have the rights protected, you don't have property. Why? Somebody else could come and take it away from you, and there's nothing you could do about it. The law is what protects you. So your property rights are those that are recognized by law. And the flip side of that coin is that the law actually evolved, that law that protects your property rights, actually evolved from property rights. What does that mean? The reason why you have property rights is because you had cases and controversy all the way back to the common law that says, in these circumstances, you have these rights. Most cases involved, as we said, property disputes because that's what people fight about in court generally. So the common law was jam-packed full of cases and controversy involving property. And as a result of that, you can see how these two are intertwined, how they're interrelated. The law protects your property rights, and the property rights issues that came about through cases and controversy built the law. And the two are intrinsically intertwined. They are grew up together. And as Jeremy Bentham said, they die together. You don't have one, you don't have the other. Okay, third, our foundations of law recognize that we are endowed by our creator. That means it's a natural right that cannot be taken away by government. We're endowed with property rights. This comes out of the Declaration of Independence. when Jefferson states that we are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, and that among them are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. When asked what the pursuit of happiness means, because it was different than what Locke had said, and every colonial person was well aware of what Locke said, that your natural rights are life, liberty, and the pursuit of property. When asked what the difference between what he wrote in 1776 and what Locke wrote in 1690, Jefferson said there's no difference, that you are endowed by your Creator with certain inalienable rights. And when he said life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, he was saying life, liberty, and the pursuit of property, no difference, same thing, just a more elegant way to say it. So recognize that as a result of that, through the Ninth Amendment, which the Declaration of Independence is incorporated by reference, where all of the rights of the people are maintained by them, and that was declared by our founders as being our fundamental rights, recognize that under our law, under the common law, and under the Declaration of the Constitution, which are protected by law, that we, the people, every individual human being, are deemed to be endowed with property rights, and that those rights cannot be taken away from us. And lastly, what are our property rights? How are they effectuated? How are they put in force and effect? Well, that's through the acronym EPUT. First is the right to exclude. You have the right as a person with the property to exclude others from its use. You have the right to possess it, the right to hold it, the right to have it. You have the right to use it. Use is a fundamental EPUT right. You have the right to use it, and that includes the right not to use it, to let it lay fallow, to leave the car in your driveway and never take it out. It's up to you. How you use it, when you use it, and the manner in which you use it are all up to you. And lastly, you have the right to transfer. That means you can sell it, you can give it away, you can lend it to people for a time. Anything of that nature, you have that right to transfer the property. And those are your major EPUT rights. Lastly, we talked and we wrapped up last time about what are the types of property in which you have rights in. First is real property. That's land. It's real estate. You have the right in land under your rights. Real property is rights in land. Personal property, which we're going to start out with tonight, is rights in objects. Whereas land can't be moved, it is affixed to the globe, you have a right in personal objects as well, which can be moved. That's tangible, visible things. Was referred to under common law as a chattel, which is movable, objected property. Rights in land are the land on the earth. Now, someday that might be land on the moon. Someday that might be land on Mars or some other foreign astrological body. If we build a gigundous space station, it could be land there. But at the end of the day, right now, the only real land that we can own is land on Earth. There has been a United Nations resolution that says that nations cannot own the moon. Whether or not that will change as more and more people are able to get to the moon and operate on the moon, whether you'll have private property rights on the moon, yet to be determined. But right now, no nation can declare that land as individual or a person to their own country. They can't claim it. As a matter of fact, when we put our flag on the moon, interestingly enough, that claim, that flag, was done so with an express caveat that we're not claiming that land, and pursuant, as we said, to the United Nations, the lands of the moon belong to all mankind. So right now, rights and land are only on Earth. That might change. Stay tuned. Personal property is whoever has it, and it's chattels, tangible, visible things. The last type of rights you have is intellectual. That's rights and ideas. Patents, an idea for a product or for a process on how to make that product. Trademarks, it's a right in a logo or an identification, such as the golden arches on McDonald's or the swoosh on the shoe of a Nike shoe. It's a distinction that is non-valuable other than to, you know, doesn't really have a value that you're putting it on. It is something that's just a mere identification of the product. And identifying that product can have a tremendous value, but the item itself doesn't. It's not the swoosh that you're paying for. It's the fact that it's a Nike sneaker that people tend to like. And lastly, you have copyrights, which are rights in written or performed works. It can be a dance, it can be a movie, it can be a recording, a song, it can be a great American novel, a book, it can be anything that is written or performed. Let's get over to a little bit of an introduction to personal property. What is the common law definitions of real and personal property? Because that's obviously, intellectual property doesn't come into play because it's not an item, it's an idea. But when you come into what makes property real, what makes property personal? Well, under the case law definitions, real property is land, things affixed to lands, or things incidental or pertinent to land. Basically, if it's immovable, can't be moved off the land, it's generally viewed as real property. Personal property, on the other hand, is movable property, and it includes virtually every kind of physical property that's not real property, such as goods, what we would traditionally call a chattel, money, notes, stock, animals. All of that is personal property. What's the statutory definition? That's the common law definitions. What's the statutory definition? I think these are weaker definitions between you and me, but it's what is in the state powers and trust law of New York State. And it says real property is land or any estate in land, including a leasehold, a fixture, that's a item of personal property attached to the land, and mortgages and liens thereon. Okay. That's a legitimate definition. But here comes personal property. Any property other than real property. Well, if you're saying it's just not real property, that makes it personal property, that's a little bit of a sketchy definition. It includes that, you know, obviously personal property is not real property, but it's more than that. It's movable property. It's got to be tangible or intangible. That means kind of very small value there. It's got to be something that you can hold in your hand, and that is personal property under the statutory definition. But as we said last week, almost all property law is based in case law, and the case law definition provides a pretty specific definition of personal property, meaning movable property that is not attached to land that has a physical manifestation. Now, can you convert real property to personal property? Can you convert personal property to real property? Yeah, you can. And that's the nature of what we call fixtures. Real property may be converted to personal property by severance. So if you take it from its attachment to the real property, then it becomes personal property. So if I have a house and I separate the house from the land, I turn it into a mobile home, I put it on a trailer and move it around, it's now personal property. Similarly, if I have a big screen TV and I attach it to the wall, it's now real property because it's a fix. But if I take it off, it becomes personal property. Severance, meaning to sever it from the real property, makes it into personal property. And you can do that. Similarly, grass growing on the ground is real property. It's part of the land. But if I cut it away and roll it up to make it a turf where I can bring it to another person's house and then roll it back down, that turf that you've rolled up into a cylinder is now personal property. When it's growing on your yard, it's real property. So basically, if you cut it away, if it's severed from the real property, it becomes personal property. Similarly, just the opposite way, if personal property is attached or annexed or somehow affixed in a permanent manner, it becomes real property. So if I take a curtain rod, which is clearly personal property because I can walk it around with me, it's movable, tangible property. If I take it and affix it to the window, so that I can hang curtains on it, it's now screwed into the window frame, that becomes real property because it's affixed to the real property. So you can convert property from real to personal and then from personal back to real, either way. Now, leases have traditionally been an issue of, is that a real property? Is it personal property? A lease is a contract. Well, is that contract real property? At common law, it was not. Common law, a lease, a agreement to rent the property, was not viewed as real property. There's a reasoning behind this. Today, it's certainly viewed as real property, the same as if you own the property. A lease is viewed as owning it for a certain period of time through the rental contract. You're basically getting the EPUT rights in the property for a period of time. That's what a lease does. But at common law, it was not, because of the fact it was viewed as personal property, because you had to own property in order to vote. Under British common law, only those who were landed property owners had the right of franchise. That means the right to cast a vote. In the United States, that was not as big a problem because in Great Britain, at the time that we fought the revolution, there were very few landowners. There was a handful of people. Land was scarce. So you had between 10 and 5% of the population actually owning the land. And in the United States, those numbers were basically reversed, where 90% of the people in the United States own the land. So that became a less important rule, whether you leased it or whether you owned it, because the super majority of people own land, because there was a lot of land in the United States. And hence, to make that an arbitrary reason for voting, as we talked about a few weeks ago when we did our constitutional discussions, the leasehold as a qualification of land ownership became less important because of the fact that so many people own their own land. And by the early 1800s, all the property owning real property owning requirements for voting went away. And most states didn't require that because most people own their own land. So it was kind of foolish to do it. Whereas in Great Britain, it was kind of a power struggle because so few people own their own land, the landed people didn't want to give up the power. And as a result, they viewed a leasehold in common law as a personal property. Today, in the law of both Great Britain and the United States, leaseholds are viewed as real property. What about crops? What about foliage, trees, grass, as we talked about before? When is that real property? When is personal property? Well, certainly, we talked about the grass. If you take the grass and roll it up into turf because you cut it away and rolled it up as a mat and thrown it in the car and taken it away, well, that certainly is goes from being real property to personal property. But what about other items? Well, there's a distinction made in the law. One is called fructus naturalis, and one is called fructus industrialis. Basically, it's a distinction based on cultivation. If God put it there, if it grew naturally, guess what? It's fructus naturalis, meaning it's natural, and it is real property. So if the tree naturally grew there, it is real property. Now, that's kind of a silly distinction because you could plant a tree. And if you plant that tree and it grows there, it's real property. And when you go to sell the house, the tree goes with it because anything attached to the land is viewed as real property. So as a result, these naturally occurring crops or land attachments, you know, the foliage, shrubs and trees and grass on the ground, all viewed as real property. If it's growing there naturally, or by and large, it grows there naturally anyway, even if you plant it there. Believe me, I planted a lot of grass seed. The grass is fructus naturalis. But when is it viewed as, because not all the time is it viewed as real property? Fructus industrialis are cultivated crops. So if I have blueberries on my property, I have a blueberry bush, and I pick the blueberries off, the blueberries become a crop. They become a item which is cultivated. It's fruit. It's not the bush. The bush is real property. But the berries that we take off are viewed as personal property. They're movable. So if I grow corn, when it's on the stalk, it's viewed as real property. When I pick it, it becomes personal property. So crops which are cultivated and harvested are deemed as personal property. The crop itself, before it gets harvested, is viewed as real property. Animals. You have two types of animals. You have domesticated animals and you have wild animals. Domesticated animals are personal property. This includes livestock and pets like cats, dogs, rabbits, chickens, horses, turtles, goldfish, any kind of domesticated pet. Now, I don't know that I can really call a goldfish a domesticated pet because you don't take it for a walk, but you certainly can own it, and it is viewed as personal property. Now, certainly there are laws and statutes and even case law about the way we treat our animals. You can't torture an animal, and you shouldn't. And because that, there are penalties for that. If you torture an animal, you can go to jail as a result. It's a crime. And similarly, in a lot of jurisdictions, you need a license for an animal. Sonny the Wonder Dog, who's my puppy, needs a license every year from the town of Glenville because they license dogs. They want to know where they are. They want to know who owns them. in case they run away and get lost. So you have to have a license for it, but it's still personal property. Certain animals, because of their nature, are required with licenses, such as, you know, if they're a hazardous animal, you know, a ferocious animal, they require certain licenses on that to have them. Not everybody can own a tiger, for example. But whenever you legally own it, then it is personal property. And it's no different in your ownership rights, other than, as I said, you can't treat it cruelly, you have to feed it, you have to care for it. But as far as your ownership rights, your e-put rights, it's the same as a lamp. There's no difference in other types of personal property, other than the fact, because it is a living being, society has said and the laws have followed that you have to treat it kindly and care for it and keep it in a safe and gentle and kind manner. Okay. What about wild animals? As we said before, wild animals in their natural state are owned by no one. They're the property of no one. It's why the law is somewhat obsessive about them, because it's one of the few pieces of property, especially personal property, that's owned by no one. You know, you start with a blank slate. To gain property rights over a wild animal requires that that animal be captured or killed. That's the only way you can gain that animal. Just merely having that animal is not. You need to capture it, have dominion and control over it, or kill it. And that's how you can take the possession of the animal. when you're capturing or killing it, it must be accomplished in accordance to law. There are hunting seasons for that. As we said, there may be specific licenses. You cannot capture or kill an endangered species. To give you an example, even though it's not particularly endangered, a porpoise, a dolphin, cannot be maintained by you as a pet. It's a violation of federal law. And there are similar laws, state and federal laws, with respect to the ownership of certain dangerous animals, as we said, such as lions or tigers or bears or alligators, because if you don't properly know how to maintain those animals, you could end up having them harm someone. So you generally have to get either a license or a permit in order to capture them, in order to maintain them. But once legally killed or captured, a former wild animal is also personal property by the person who kills or captures them, same as a domesticated animal. Fixtures. A fixture is quite simply something you attach to real property. It starts out as personal property. When you attach it, it becomes real property. When you detach it, it becomes personal property again. In order to become a fixture, in order to become real property, it has to be permanently attached. You just can't set it down on the ground and say, oh, that's real property. You have to attach it. You have to affix it. And once it does, it becomes real property. Well, that's our introduction. Next one, we're going to move in to additional items with respect to personal property, and we'll see you shortly. Thanks so much.